line of all this, from my empirical experience of 10 years of twiddling 915 megacycle antennas in front of a very well-calibrated Rohde & Schwarz vector network analyzer, where day in and day out, hours on every day, I am simultaneously looking at standing wave ratio as the yellow curve and gain as the blue curve, and those two curves are superimposed on the same XY plot. Horizontal axis is frequency, vertical axis is either gain or standing wave ratio. Two separate vertical axes. But the two curves are superimposed with two different colors on that screen. And with tuning tools and my antenna range that was exactly 3 feet long between my desk and the conference table, and a bunch of, and the antennas under test were sitting on chunks of blue foam, the foam you can get out of a supply house for building materials, the stuff that they use for insulation in buildings. That foam is 2 pounds per cubic foot. It's got a dielectric constant of 1.002 or something like that, very close to air. You set up any of these antennas sitting on that block of foam, the antenna thinks it's in air. It thinks it's in free space. And now, with tuning tools, which are chunks of copper on the end of a long wooden rod, and you bring those tuning tools near the tip of one of the dipoles of the antenna, you're adding capacitance to the tip, and you're moving it down in frequency of resonance, and you watch the display. Did the gain get better, and did the VSWR get better? If so, keep doing it. If one of them got worse, find some other way of getting around the problem, if you know what I mean. But by tuning like that, I can test 100 different antenna designs in an 8-hour day. Let me drop. You try to do that exact same process with computer modeling, and you try to put in all the finite elements. It would take you thousands of finite elements to take that wide piece of copper for the director, the white piece of copper for the driven element, and the white piece of copper for the reflector, and the white piece of copper for the boom that's in between the three. And that boom, by the way, is offset a little bit to one side for a magic reason. But you take all of that jazz and try to, by finite element analysis, put it into a computer. And you let it grind for about an hour, and it comes up with an answer, which, by the way, has got more error than answer. And then you decide to make a modification. You're going to make the element a little bit fatter, a little bit longer. And you're going to readjust all those finite elements to do that. And you wait another hour for another answer. Whereas with that tuning tool, on a real scale, on a real-time vector network analyzer, which is giving you 30 displays per second on that screen, I don't even see any flicker. To me, it's a thoroughly real-time, continuously moving screen as I'm holding that tuning tool near the tip of an element. I immediately get the answer. As I add capacitance to the tip of that element, did the answer get better or worse? If I got better, keep doing it. If I got worse, I do something else. I've got the answer in a couple of seconds. It would take me an hour of grinding on the computer modeling program if it could handle it. And I chose a couple of people who I know, let me drop, to be quasi-experts on computer modeling programs. And I'm talking about two very expensive programs. One's called High Frequency Structure Simulator, and the other one was called CST Microwave Studio. Take those two, very respected, very expensive, when you buy all the goodies, computer modeling program, and you take my resultant antenna that's patented and plug in the raw data into that computer program, and it gives you a performance that's not even mediocre. It can't see the performance, because when you put in that elaborate, that many thousands of finite elements into a great big matrix in that program, and it has to invert that matrix in complex mathematics and do it with high accuracy, it can't do it in any reasonable length of time. So the best computer modeling programs that I was available up to 2010 could not handle this situation. But we ham radio tweakers, by the real empirical experiment, can come up with an answer in seconds or minutes. Is it better or worse? Do you see the value of being a ham radio operator? You want to be a good antenna designer. In 2014, hire a ham. N2 Moon Bounce, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, actually, in your answer, you brought up something that I forgot, and that's why I was a little confused. The presence of an antenna only there because what it's made out of is a different dielectric constant than the air around it. So, I mean, I didn't put it that way in my mind. But now I understand what you're saying. It's a little lesson that I forgot, a little something that I forgot there. Now that you bring it out, it makes a lot of sense. Thank you, sir.
And with that understanding that you've just gotten again, Barry, you apply it to another crazy point. All the antennas you and I build are usually a thin conductor in insulating space. That's what does the radiating. But the inverse is absolutely usable. If all of space was a conductor, and somewhere in the middle of that conductor you put an empty space, you've got an antenna. It's called a slot antenna. Take a very wide chunk of sheet metal and cut a slot in it. And the slot is a half wavelength long, and let me pick a number, a 16th of an inch wide. You cut that slot in that great big sheet of metal. It's called a slot antenna. It'll have the exact same pattern and the exact same gain as a dipole antenna. That's the exact same length and the exact same width made out of conductor. In other words, the inverse antenna is the exact same antenna with one catch. Polarization is reversed. If I cut a horizontal slot in a great big sheet of metal, and it makes it horizontal slot, half wavelength long, a 16th of an inch wide, and I build another antenna, which is made out of a copper strip, half inch wide, half wavelength long, and I compare the gain and the pattern of those two antennas. They will be identical. But the horizontal slot of narrow material in air, the horizontal slot of conductor in air, will be horizontally polarized. The horizontal slot in the great big sheet of metal will be vertically polarized. The voltage appears across the gap. And so the gap, you can see how you can excite a voltage between the top of the gap and the bottom of the gap. You can see how there's going to be a voltage drop across the gap that gives you a hint as to why it's going to be vertically polarized. So slot antennas and dipole antennas are the identical antenna, except
repeater, timeout.
The identical antenna, except that one is horizontally polarized and one is vertically polarized. Now, once you've got that sheet of metal and you're cutting slots in it, you've got all kinds of ways you can cut those slots. You can cut them as a Maltese cross, as a cross that looks like a Christian cross, as an X-wing fighter type cross, as circles, as diamonds. There's all kinds of ways you can cut the slot, and each one of those has its own resonant frequency and its own antenna pattern. And you carry that far enough with that great big sheet of metal, and you step and repeat with the way you cut those slots. You are now building what's called a frequency selective surface. You can design those slots on that sheet of metal so that the signal will go through the slots and it becomes the equivalent of a phased array antenna. Or it favors certain angles, favors certain frequencies, favors certain polarizations. That sheet of metal could be the sheet of metal you're using as a radome over your VHF, UHF antenna. And you can make the slots in that radome favor certain frequencies and reject everything else. It becomes a three-dimensional bandpass filter. Ain't that crazy? Can you see some of the ideas as to what you can do with that, Barry? N2 Moonbounds, K2RIW.
Of course, I've never understood slot antennas. I do now, a little bit. And I'm going to have to close my eyes and think about that for a while. I get it. I understand what you're saying. But it's a concept which is still alien to me because I just learned it. So I'll see you next week and see how much more I know about that. Thank you so much, N2MB.
Your very first question, Barry, is going to be, how the hell do I feed this thing? I've got this great big sheet of metal. I've taken out my X-Acto knife, and I've cut this horizontal slot across it. I've now got a horizontal slot, which is a vertically polarized halfway dipole, and now I want to put a feed line on there. Okay. If right across the center of the slot, I put my piece of semi-rigid coax cable, where the shield is welded to the soldered to the bottom of the slot, semiconductor is soldered to the top of the slot, right in the middle of the slot, middle meaning halfway from left to right. If I did that, I would have an impedance of around 1,000 ohms. If I take that piece of semi-rigid cable and start sliding it left or right toward the end, the impedance will get lower and lower. So if my slot happened to be 4.5 inches long, because I'm building it at 915 megs, it's 4.5 inches long, and if I feed it about 3/4 of an inch from the left-hand end, put the semi-rigid cable right across the slot, I will probably be at the 50-ohm point on the antenna. As I go closer and closer to the short circuit end, so to speak, the impedance will go down. As I get closer to the center, it'll go up. I can get around 1,000 ohms in the center. I can get 0 ohms at the left-hand edge and everything in between. Let me drop. Now, that piece of semi-rigid cable soldered down to the wide sheet of copper, semiconductor to the lower end of the slot, shield to this lower end, semiconductor to the upper end, that is simultaneously a perfect impedance match transmission line feeding of the slot, and it's simultaneously a full bowing structure. Ain't that crazy? Ain't nothing simpler in the world. It's simultaneously a balun and an impedance matching structure, and you can get any impedance you want out of that. And by making the slot a little bit longer, a little bit shorter, I can make the slot slightly inductive or slightly capacitive. I can also take a sheet of scotch tape, put the sheet of scotch tape across the center of the slot. Now lay a very small piece of copper tape on top of the scotch tape. I'm adding a center loading capacitor. The antenna will go down in frequency when I do that. And I can take that small piece of copper tape on top of the scotch tape. The scotch tape, by the way, is a very high quality dielectric material at 915 megacycles. Who the hell would have ever believed that? And with a pair of fiberglass tweezers, I slowly peel off that piece of copper tape, that little sliver of copper tape I've got on top of the scotch tape, and I watch the screen. I will watch the frequency of resonance go up as I peel it off. I can decide how far to peel it in order to get whatever resonant frequency I want. Do you see how easy it is to tune and feed a slot antenna? N2 moon bounce? You better start building some of these, Barry. KQRIW in the TechNet.
Okay, just because the whole concept is still a little confusing to me. I'm not going to lie about that. I get it, but I'm losing a little bit. How do you make a two-element beam with the slot? Once you get past that one, I think I'll be good at this.
I will admit I have not done this, but there's nothing stopping you from putting at a wide sheet of metal a pair of horizontal slots. I'm doing it at 915 megs, so each slot is roughly 4.5 inches long, and I build a pair of slots that are separated by, let me pick a number, 2 inches, one above the other. And I feed the bottom slot, I call that the driven element, and the next slot above that, depending on what length I adjust it to, I call that the director. And build another slot below the center one, make it a little bit longer, and I call that reflector. I'm not positive because I said I haven't done this, but I think I have just constructed, in the slot structure, I've just constructed a three-element Yagi antenna. N2 moon bounce, K2RIW.
Okay. I think I got that. Now, does the slots have to be more than a certain width? You know, in other words, I mean the metal around the slot. Because when you cut this line in the copper, how small can the copper be before it couldn't be used for a slot antenna?
There's no limit on that one, Barry. You can make the copper go to infinity. You can make the copper go 3 inches more in every direction, 2 inches more in every direction, 1 inch more in every direction. If you have one simple slot dipole and you start cutting away the copper as much as possible, eventually it's called a skeleton slot antenna. And that is a popular antenna in some of the antenna books. There is no magic width of copper where the slot antenna stops working. It changes in characteristics frequency, but any width of copper can be made into a slot antenna. To be a pure slot antenna where it obeys all of the simple conversions from ordinary dipole in space to a slot antenna on a piece of copper, to make it have an exact duality, you'd like the piece of copper to be, let me pick a number, a wavelength wide in all directions. But as you start whittling it away, it doesn't suddenly stop working. It slowly shifts in resonant frequency, slowly shifts in radiation pattern. But it doesn't stop working just because you're too skimpy on the amount of copper you're using. Ain't that magic? Into Moonbounce, K2RIW.
Okay, so in other words, it could be reduced to a loop of wire. That would work.
The loop of wire fed in that manner is called a skeleton slot antenna. It's called skeleton because you've chopped away as much of the copper sheet as you can. Over to you, Barry. Yes, that works.
Okay, that's great. It's really interesting. And I am going to give that some serious thought. I like that. That's really nice. Thank you so much. You've given me something to worry about this week. I love it.
So we have, Dick, I have something totally different to bring up, if you have a chance to answer. We have.
Yeah, I think we'll get you in a minute, sir. Let me not lose this one yet, though, because I've got an interested party here. And he's in the learning mode, I can tell. He's sucking this up like a sponge. The magic of an antenna is the magic of resonance. 99% of all the antennas we build work well if and only if they hit resonance at your favorite frequency. Now, what are the ways in which you can build a resonator? There's a zillion of them. Let me drop them. Hairpin coils, helical wound coils, straight out coils, cavity resonators. There's a zillion ways you can build a resonator. And as long as you've built a resonator that is not thoroughly shielded, it is an antenna. So, build various resonators, displace them whatever way you want to in three-dimensional space, properly feed them and impedance match them, and you've got antennas with all kinds of antenna patterns. And the pattern is coming from interferometry. If there's more than one element to your antenna, that's what a two-element Yagi or a three-element Yagi is. There's three elements. You could call it three elements of interferometry. The so-called passive director is absorbing some of that energy out of the driven element and re-radiating it. It's a second source of signal, as if you had put a second feed line there, but you didn't have to bother wasting the time doing it. The coupling of free space did that for you. You take the radiated signal with its phase angle coming off the director, the radiated signal with its phase angle coming off the driven element, the radiated signal with its phase angle coming off the reflector, and you add them up in any point in space that you care about. You consider the interferometry of those three elements, add them up at some particular point in space. You now know the pattern in three-dimensional space of that antenna. Let me drop it. Every antenna that's got any kind of a pattern beyond isotropic, inside of that antenna is an interferometer. The highest gain antenna any of us knows about is that 2-inch or 3-inch diameter parabolic reflector that's on your flashlight. Assuming the manufacturer of your flashlight had done an accurate job of building that parabolic reflector, and if temporarily I make a leap of faith, and I assume that the filament of the bulb in your flashlight is a point source. In reality, it's distributed. But if I assume it's a point source, and if the reflector was perfect, out of the front end of that reflector, if it was a 2-inch diameter reflector, out of that flashlight comes a 2-inch diameter beam. And you would like to believe that the 2-inch diameter beam stays 2-inch in diameter until it goes out there 1,000 yards and hits that garage door, and you get a reflection. You do that experiment, and you'll find out, hey, it ain't 2 inches in diameter, whips the garage. It's a couple of feet in diameter. It's spread out. Why? We call it diffraction. But what that really means is it's got an antenna pattern. You're looking at the main lobe of that antenna pattern. Let me drop. And if this is the best of all worlds, you would like that main lobe to have a beam width of 0 degrees. You can't do that. The because the outer perimeter of that parabolic reflector is only a certain number of wavelengths out there. So if I analyze the signal coming from the north end of that parabolic reflector, I take a little square of that signal, and I take a little square of the signal off of the south end of the parabolic reflector, and they add those two signals together as an interferometer. I've got the beginning of that antenna pattern. It's an interferometry pattern. In reality, the reflector has also got little squares of reflector that are slightly closer to the center. You add them all up, that's where the antenna pattern comes from. It's a multi-element interferometer. That parabolic reflector on your flashlight is the equivalent of a 1,000-element phased array antenna, because I can divide that flashlight reflector into 1,000 little squares. I can analyze what's going on in each little square. I consider that a completely separate dipole antenna. It almost is, except the dipole has got polarization, and the signal coming off your light bulb filament has no polarization. So except for that, those little dipole antennas, I add them all together. That is the antenna pattern of that flashlight. If the manufacturer has done a perfect job of building that parabolic reflector, and if that light bulb had zero dimension of its radiation, if it was a point source, then by definition, that would be a diffraction-limited telescope. Diffraction-limited means that all of the little portions of the parabolic shape are accurate to the nearest 20th of a wavelength, and the signal is coming from a point source of nearly zero wavelength dimension, 20th of a wavelength, and that signal is coming from the focal point of the reflector. You put that all together, it's called diffraction limited. If you do it as a viewing device, we call it a diffraction limited telescope. Diffraction limited means that within that diameter of that telescope, you have done everything perfect. There is no higher performance you can get. Diffraction limited telescope is a telescope with the highest possible performance. It's got nearly perfect accuracy of the mirror. The mirror is probably a 20th of a wavelength accurate. If you now made it a 40th of a wavelength accurate, you would not see any significant increase in performance. But the diffraction limited performance gives you a predictable amount of beam width. That beam width is 1.22 lambda over diameter in units of radians. That's the diffraction limited formula that all the telescope people use. Well, you and I don't live in the radian world. We live in the degree world. So take the 1.22, convert it to 70. 70 lambda over D is the beam width of your flashlight in degrees. Notice the relationship between that and the rule of thumb that all the antenna people use. Let me drop it. And that is, somebody has told you how big is the parabolic reflector, how big is the mouth of the horn, how big is the dipole, whatever. How big is the signal that's being radiated? How big is the forward surface of the mouth of the signal being radiated? You calculate that in wavelengths, divide it into 70 degrees, and that is the 3 dB beam width of that antenna. If the throat of the horn of my antenna was 70 wavelengths wide, 70 divided into 70 is 1, my horn, by definition, would have a 1 degree beam width. It's almost a 1-to-1 relationship with the so-called diffraction-limited telescope. The mathematics works the same, even though it's two different fields. One case we're talking about an optical telescope, one case we're talking about a radio telescope, one case I'm talking about my flashlight, one case I'm talking about my phased array antenna. It's all the exact same phenomena. Diffraction is where the antenna pattern is coming from. I'm reasonably convinced those are 95% accurate words. I can't find those words in any respected antenna book. I can't find those words spoken by any respected professor of antenna engineering. Let me drop. It may be where the real pattern is coming from, and nobody tells you that. In all the books you read and all the courses you take, they give you a formula. They say, plug in the numbers. That will be the beam width of the antenna. Yeah, that's true. But now you've got to memorize this and figure out and see if you can remember it in order to use it 10 years downrange. If they went one step further and explained how that pattern comes about, how those computer programs calculate antenna pattern, what are they really doing inside that program? It is comments on all the above, give me a call, Liz. KJRIW in the TechNet.
WA2VDH.
Saying that I was comparing that to some of my big radio antennas. You know I've had some big ones. Makes more sense for some reason when you think of it in the RF field instead of the light range. Anyway, back over to you.
Okay, I heard BDH and Eric in that order. WA2BDH, I should know. Please start off with your name, sir. KJRIW. My name is Dick.
Yeah, fine business, Dick. Yeah, the call is WA2 Victor David Henry. Name is John. I just had a question on your example with the light source. Does that light source have to be monochromatic for you to consider it in terms of interferometry? Go ahead.
To be absolutely accurate, you're absolutely right, Joe, but there's a catch. The optical frequencies you and I care about, 400 to 700 millimicrons, 400 to 700 nanometers, is only a 2-to-1 frequency region. Yeah, the filament happens to be putting out some infrared, near infrared, far infrared, putting out all kinds of frequencies, but we don't look at those frequencies. It may also be putting out some ultraviolet. We don't look at those frequencies. Your eye doesn't operate there. The real frequency region over which your eye has maximum performance is somewhere around 650 to 400 nanometers. That's less than a 2-to-1 frequency region. And although what comes out of the filament of that light bulb is covering to some degree that frequency region, and it's not thoroughly coherent, if you consider it coherent at 550 nanometers, let me drop. If you consider it a perfectly crystal controlled frequency at 550 nanometers, and you do the calculation, you'll come up with 95% accuracy, close enough. So, in the nitty gritty, you're absolutely right, Joe. But if you just don't worry about those fine details, you'll come up with an answer that's pretty close to the same answer. W2 Victor David Hotel, K2RIW, got it, Joe.
Oh, yeah, okay, fine business, Dick. Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, the handle is John. Also, I think that middle of the optical range is like that yellow-green color of the old Pickett slide rules. I remember they used to optimize them for the best sensitivity of the eyes. Fine business. Thanks very much, Dick. Appreciate it.
Hey, John. I'm down to my last two log-log deci-trig Pickett slide rules. And yes, they do have that very high visibility yellowish green background with black lettering on them. On my newest one, my older one had the white background, not quite as visible, and it was an earlier version which the paint chips off on it a little bit more easily. So in their day, in the mid-60s, the state-of-the-art of portable calculators was a metal-backed Pickett slide rule or a bamboo-backed post slide rule. That was the K&E slide rules. We've come a long way since then. You barely get 3 decimal places of accuracy out of a analog computing device called slide rule, maybe as much as 4. Whereas a modern-day handheld calculator, 12 decimal places of accuracy is easy, and 16 or 24 is possible in the high-precision mode. Let me drop. Now, Eric had some comments on all of this. KE2EJ, a man who has ground his own parabolic telescope mirror to near 20th of a degree of a wavelength of accuracy. KE2EJ, K2RIW. Go ahead, Eric.
K2RIW, KE2EJ. Sounds like you need to do your vocal cords a little hydrating. Maybe you're under the weather a little bit. I just tuned in a little bit ago. As far as flat antennas go, that's pretty much what we use for transmitting television in the UHF range. And one of the nice things about it is that you can make them very broadband and very flat, which is really nice. Actually, the one in Plainview is built around a 8-inch piece of pipe. Actually, it's quite long and it's quite heavy, and it has 22 dB of gain, really great. And I liked your explanation of the factor-limited devices. It should actually be something that or anybody that's teaching it, if you realize that you have a, in the case of an optical device like a telescope, you have a limited area. I like the way you break it up into little bits. And actually, that's the principle that some of these huge super telescopes are built around, where they actually use little quadrants of mirrors to create the entire capture area. Oh, and by the way, Dick, did you get those papers that I sent you? I sent them both email addresses, so I'm sure you read them. You know, it's just nice reading. K2RIW, K2J, by the way, I'm on my way to Empire.
Yeah, that is the building in New York City when it comes to radiating RF energy for television and FM broadcasts and whatever. Yes, I am hydrating as much as I can. And it's a cold that I think has developed into a flu. The wife and I have it. And we're suffering through it. Yes, I did get the things that you mailed me. Very nicely done. Right now I'm foggy brain that I've forgotten the subject, but it was very nicely done material, which maybe we should be putting on the Mike Number 2 website. When it comes to the question that was asked 2 weeks ago, and last week we didn't get to it, where we talked about very long baseline interferometry, where in theory, you take the radio telescope that's in Socorro, New Mexico, a multi-element array that all by itself gives you some beautiful radio astronomy pictures. Let me drop it. And you combine that with multiple other antennas. Let me just choose an example. You go to Honeysuckle Creek, Australia, where they got a 240-foot diameter parabolic dish, and you and Australia, you on Socorro, New Mexico, and your buddy in Honeysuckle Creek, Australia, decide to both aim at the same star system simultaneously. Maybe it's a nebula. And he aims his antenna there for the next 2 hours. You aim your antenna there for the next 2 hours. And you make very high performance recordings of everything you see. And then you bring those two recordings to a central place and process that data. Because those two telescopes are in the vicinity of 5,000 miles apart, maybe 7,000 miles, some good number of miles. That is going to give you the angular resolution of a telescope that's 5,000 miles in diameter. Let me drop it. I didn't say it's going to give you the light gathering information of a 5,000 mile diameter telescope. And it's going to get, not going to, at first, give you the prettiness of picture. It's going to be a whole bunch of interferometry lobes in that picture, but it's got high resolution. And you put those two data sets into the right kind of a computer program that does an inverse Fourier transform. It's the equivalent of a CAT scan machine. It's the equivalent of a holography display. You put that all together correctly, where you're really adding up all those phase angles and amplitudes, and you will get a much higher resolution picture of what that nebula looks like that both of you are looking at this instant of time. So long baseline interferometry gives you some of the benefit of a very large telescope that you could never really synthesize in the real world. Some of the really good modern day optical telescopes are combining multiple mirrors that are quite often hexagonal in shape, approximately 4 meters or 8 meters in diameter. They discovered at the University of Arizona that if you're real careful with the right procedure, you can make a darn good diffraction-limited optical telescope parabolic mirror 4 or 8 meters in diameter. And now if you want a telescope that's bigger than that, you combine multiple elements of that and put them into a frame where you can adjust the individual positions and angular aimings of each of those elements. You put them into a great big frame, set that up with computer optimization to take care of gravity, temperature expansion, wind loading, and whatever. And now you can make a very large telescope. And some of the modern-day telescopes are doing that. The telescopes on the ground, even though they got to look through this really yucky atmosphere, compared to that beautiful Hubble Space Telescope that's in the vacuum of space, well above the atmosphere, we're getting to the point now where the ground-based telescopes are exceeding the resolution of Hubble, exceeding the performance of Hubble on the ground. You might now ask yourself the question, let me drop it. Are we in the near future going to build a twice-diameter Hubble? I think the answer is no, with one catch. James Webb Space Telescope is going to have two or three times the diameter of Hubble, but there's a catch. That's in a different position. It's at Lagrange Point number 2, I think it is. It's 1,000,000 miles away from Earth, on the backside of the Earth, away from the Sun. That's where it's going to be mounted. I think it's launched in the year of 2018. And it's a very large diameter infrared telescope. So by having the biggest diameter multi-element parabolic mirror that you can devise for infrared frequencies, state-of-the-art detectors on infrared, a James Webb telescope is probably going to make as many breakthroughs as Hubble did, because each time you choose a new frequency region of the spectrum that goes, we used to call it DC to light, now we got to call it DC to gamma ray. Let me drop it. You take any brand new portion of that spectrum and you build a state-of-the-art telescope there, and you start making observations, you're going to see things you've never seen before. The Hubble Space Telescope gives you some beautiful high-resolution pictures of the things you're looking at. But there's a catch. It does it primarily at optical frequencies. The advantage of infrared frequencies is it can look through a hell of a lot of dust and see what's going on in the middle of that cloud where a new star and a new solar system is being born. In the middle of that cloud where the center of a galaxy is developing or is increasing the size of its supermassive black hole that holds the whole galaxy together. With infrared, you can now get much greater penetration of those seemingly opaque dust clouds and really find out what's going on and watch the process of birth and watch the process of destruction during supernovas and so on. You're going to get a much bigger picture, pun intended, of what's really happening in space. And when the James Webb Space Telescope eventually does its equivalent of the deep field, the ultra deep field and the extremely deep field picture, and it looks out there in space at 3.65 billion light years, and you see what the perimeter of the observable universe really looks like, and you see how fast the stuff out there is accelerating away from us, guarantee you're going to get brand new answers you never anticipated. Anybody got any further questions or comments on this subject? K2RIW, the Tech Man. Okay, I think I heard John number 1 and John number 2 in that order. John number 1, KC2WGB, go ahead.
Yes, Dick, I just want to let you know there's two articles, I thank Eric for that. One was from Roden Schwartz on DD, and the other article was on SWR. Two excellent written objects, articles to read. Back to you, Dick.
And the timing of that is interesting. The monthly journal of the Great South Bay Amateur Radio Club has a technical article. The second in a series of articles trying to explain decibels and what they really mean and how to do forward decibel conversion and inverse decibel conversion. A fair number of amateurs have trouble with decibels, and I can understand that. The whole concept of how decibels work or how logarithms work is a little bit spooky. Just like I have a fair amount of trouble understanding what's really going on with a... can't think of the name of the mathematics right now. The mathematics by which we calculate FM sidebands. It'll come to me.
Comment on the space telescope, KD2CXK?
Dick. Okay, we've got a whole lot of double CXK. Go ahead.
Bessel function.
You're right, Bessel function. Thank you. CXK, you got it.
KD2CXK. First, Dick, hope your throat starts to feel better. Seems to be degrading over the past 40 minutes, so take care of yourself. On the space telescope, I do remember a question that had come up recently about the advantages and disadvantages. At one point, will ground-based telescopes surpass the imaging resolution of space-based telescopes, primarily because we can make much larger mirrors down here than we can, of course, cost-effectively launch into space. Now with the adaptive optics, of so-called, the correction for the anomalies in the atmosphere, one thing nobody's really talking about is that space-based telescopes can do something that ground-based telescopes have a huge problem with, no matter how advanced you make the optics, and that is seeing the ultraviolet spectrum. Our atmosphere does a tremendously good job of not cooking us and also filtering out a whole lot of ultraviolet light that would normally reach these telescopes. So that's where the space ones have a one-up. KD2, CXK, back to net.
Very fine, Craig. And yes, if you really want the whole picture, you want to look at your astronomical object in long-range radio, short-range radio, millimeter wave radio, long-range infrared, short-wave infrared, optical, near-ultraviolet, far-ultraviolet, X-ray, and gamma ray. DC to gamma ray. You'd like to look at the whole spectrum if you want to get the whole picture. And the atmosphere is only transparent around 470 to 700 nanometers. That happens to be almost the exact frequency region that your eye is designed for. So the light coming from the sun, coming through our atmosphere, has a window around those wavelengths, and the eye is designed for those wavelengths. That's not a coincidence. If you have any faith in evolution, you'd realize that human beings with optical sensors, let me drop this. Optical sensors that favors the exact frequency region where the atmosphere is transparent would give you greatest visibility. And because it's a super high frequency compared to radio frequencies, even though your eye at high noon only has maybe a 2 millimeter aperture of the iris, a 2 meter aperture with a well-focused optical system can give you an angular resolution of 1/60th of a degree, 1 minute of arc. Your eye can have that much angular resolution. That allows you to resolve objects in front of you very nicely. A lower frequency, you'd have to have a much bigger eye in order to get angular resolution. A much higher frequency, you'd now have to design plasma light. You'd have to design, what am I thinking of now? The material that you make human beings out of. You have to design those materials that would be transparent to ultraviolet. That would be difficult. So it's a very well-designed human eye designed for this particular environment.
Pick up N2EO.
Yeah, okay. So you put your telescope above that atmosphere, and you get above that filter, that bandpass filter. And now you can look DC to gamma ray, and there's a lot to be seen out there. Okay. Craig runs the astronomy net on Thursday nights on Limark, and I think it's the second and third Thursday of the month. Correct me on that, Craig. I believe it starts at 8:30 at night, and by now you've probably had 20 or so astronomy sessions. Is that true, Craig? KD2CXK, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yes, Dick. Actually, we're moving the net in the new year. It'll be the first and third Tuesdays of the week, and that, of course, will be on the Whiskey 2 Victor Lima machine at 8:30. Runs about an hour to an hour and a half, and the reason we're moving it is I need my Thursdays, and I think we're going to get a slightly better audience on Tuesdays. Some of our local astronomy bus will be more available. Next thing, we've had about 27, 29, I have to double check the record since, so we just passed a year, and it's been so far so good. And of course I don't get offended that you're moving in on my action talking about this. On that note, I hope you do feel better again. KD2CXK, back to net.
Craig, one of the questions I was asked last week was the Geminid meteor shower, which I think was supposed to peak on December 12th, two or so days ago, and sometimes Geminid meteor shower lasts for as long as a week or so. From your ear to the ground, so to speak, up till now, how was the Geminid meteor shower of 2014? Was it reasonably successful? Did the people on the East Coast see enough meteors per hour to keep them happy? Give us a few words on that one, because we were specifically asked that question last week. KD2CXK, K2LIW.
Well, Dick, from what I heard, there was a big question about where you were viewing from. A good portion of the area around us has been suffering with overcast and not favorable seeing conditions until, a lot of those have been good windows prior to the peak of the meteor shower and then poor conditions after. But then again, you also have to realize that meteor showers don't have great counts every single year. There are some years that are better than others. This year was not considered to be a spectacular count of meteors per hour. So I think I don't have the information in front of me, but I think if you saw 15 or so, you were considered in a good spot. Now this meteor shower in specific does have a few days ahead and a few days behind where it's possible to see. So can you still see tonight? Possibly. I can't give you a count. I don't know what the favorable conditions are for tonight, but in most cases, you do want to be around 2 a.m., 3 a.m. Those are usually, for meteor showers, the peak times. So if you can bear the cold, you can probably see one. But this was not supposed to be a super spectacular year either way. I hope that answers. KD2, CXK, back to them.
And when it comes to bear the cold, that's primarily a function of what clothing you wear. As you guys have heard me say before, in the Winter Olympics in Lillehammer, Norway, about 10 or so years ago, where the weather was minus 40 degrees almost every day, and the Olympiads were bitching and moaning about how cold it was when they walked from the dormitory to the cafeteria to the auditorium where the event was taking place. They were really complaining about the cold. And the people who lived in Lillehammer saying, we don't have cold weather. You have inadequate clothing. If you own that Maine Ranger coat sold by L.L. Bean, it's a slightly expensive coat, and I think it's guaranteed to keep you warm at least down to minus 20. That, with the right kind of gloves and hat and ski pants and whatever, with the right clothing, you'll be warm. I'm talking about not the minus 30 degree wind with a 30 knot wind, minus 30 degree weather. There is something they use in the article, the 30-30 rule. Exposed flesh in a 30 knot wind at minus 30 degrees centigrade supposedly freezes solid in 30 seconds. It's a slight exaggeration, but it gets the point across. You can lose heat real fast. So what do you do, Craig, to stay warm? Go ahead, back to you, Craig.
Okay, well, the first thing is not to have Renard's syndrome. So if you know what that is and you suffer from that, you're really going to hate viewing in the winter. There's not much you're going to be able to do except maybe a thermal suit or an environment suit they use in NASA. So let's get past that. Well, the first thing is, and I've done my share of winter viewing and cold weather viewing until the wee hours, and yes, you do want to be warm. Gloves is kind of important, but you don't want to have gloves with fingers because then you're not going to be able to feel anything. And nothing is worth dropping a $500 eyepiece because it slipped through your fuzzy velvet gloves. But I will tell you, the first thing you want to pay attention to is your boots. When you're out there in a field, you get cold from the ground up. Most people out there who are standing in one place too long on a cold ground are going to feel it in their feet well before they ever feel it in their shoulders or chest or their arms. So that's really rule number one. I've been doing the warm, fuzzy socks and good boots for many years, and that has been better than a down parka, a letter drop. Okay, the next thing is, as far as the Arctic is too, and our LDT was recognized there, is clothing. A bunch of years back on an eBay auction, I purchased, for the hell of it, I purchased a pair of down pants manufactured by the Eliesca Clothing Company, which was a specific contract company that was created to manufacture the clothing worn by the people who built the Alaska pipeline. And for most people who don't know this, those people worked around the clock, three shifts all year round. And some people were recording, working and welding in 70 below, 60 below or something like that with wind. And this clothing was able to keep them warm. The pants I brought, I couldn't get the jacket, but I got the pants, were so heavy, they probably weighed 10 pounds without anyone in them. And I used to have a little thing that if you came over to my house and you could wear the pants inside for 20 minutes, I'd give you $20. And I've never paid out a dime. KD2CXK, back to that.
Yeah, Matt recognized. I'm going to pick you up in a second. A good ham radio buddy of mine, 3 or 4 years in a row, accepted an assignment down at McMurdo Bay, I think it is, at the South Pole. And the people there get issued a very characteristic red coat made by a company called Canada Goose. And that down-filled red coat made by Canada Goose keeps them warm in that high wind and cold temperatures they get down there. Do any of your astronomy people use a Canada Goose coat? Apparently there are a couple of websites that will sell you brand new or used, and I think you get a lot for your money out of those. Over to you, Craig, K2RIW.
No, Dick, but it's funny you should mention that. One of my clients is a clothing store in Chelsea, New York, and I guess it's okay to plug them here. It's called Dave's Army Navy, and they're on 6th Avenue and 16th Street. They actually sell Canada Goose. They're one of the few places that sell it. And it is very, very possible to walk in there and buy a down parka that will set you back 4 digits. And it is a very, very special jacket, and I think it is either 900 or 1100 power fill down with all kinds of membranes on it. So this is about as warm as you can get off the shelf. And of course, if $1,000 isn't good to spend, one of the best coats for being able to pack in and put on is a North Face Baltoro, which is, I think, 600 or 900 fill down. These are probably the two benchmarks for real cold weather standing still jackets. Pants, you can use almost anything. You want to keep your torso and your core warm. These are not going to be, they're bulky, but they're light and they work. Once you buy it, you'll never get rid of it. Back to you, Dick.
And that's a good way to get that. That's a good way to get that kind of a coat in a hurry. But if you're willing to wait a week, and if you go to the website of Canada Goose in Canada, I think their typical Antarctic coat sold by the, it's sold to the people down there where they get numbers like minus 70 and 30 knot winds, and people wear that coat, and as long as they protect their feet and the rest of their body, that coat does the job. I think brand new from Canada Goose, the coat is in the vicinity of $475, brand new, and used for numbers like 250, 300. So if money is the object, you might want to go directly to the manufacturer. If you want it immediately today, then go to New York City and buy it. Those are some of my guesses. Matt, I bet you've run into situations where cold weather is a problem. Back to you, Matt. K2RIW in the Tech Net.
This is 2EO, third time, Dick.
Matt, I'm not sure you passed it back to us. We heard your first two words, and you went into a spot where you had no coverage to the machine. You want to try again, Matt? K2RIW.
Several
days
in the house.
Matt, you're in a bad spot, and we never even heard 5% of what you're saying. So that message was lost. Rich, N2EO, K2RIW. Be good, Rich.
Okay, Dick, very good. And 2EO. Yeah, I wanted to get in at the beginning of the net, but I was sleeping. I came in here around 8:30 in the middle. First off, you know, that cold, whatever you have, be very careful. I developed it. The doctor told me it was the beginnings of pneumonia. I saw on Friday. I got to go back Monday. Tomorrow. Had a chest x-ray. I'm going to get the results tomorrow. But a friend of mine, a big strapping Irishman, a ham, a number of years ago, waited too long and he wound up dead. So anyway, to the wise, be careful. Let me give you what I got here. And we'll get out of that subject. Stand by. Last summer, my sweetie Patricia had a cell phone on, forget the company, I have the same company here. Her grandson took it, whatever reason, 3 years old, and threw it in the baby pool. So that was the end of the phone. She would have to buy a replacement, very expensive, to buy another replacement without insurance. So that was the end of that. Anyway, I have an attendant here because, you know, my problem with the spine and one leg now with the diabetes getting amputated. And he has a phone on a company called Simple Mobile. The $25 a month.
KC2YDT is back on the base, Dick, when you're ready.
But you can use internet Wi-Fi in your home or McDonald's for that, or a hotspot. Anyway, he told me what an unlocked phone is. I never know. An unlocked phone is a phone that will go on virtually any system. Most phones, if you buy an AT&T, it'll only do that. If you buy a Verizon, it'll only do that. An unlocked phone will go on any network. You just got to put the right SIM card in. Let me go to recycle. Anyway, this fella here, he knows how to save money. He's from West Africa, from the country of Nigeria, born and raised in Lagos. Very intelligent man. He bought a phone on Amazon.com called it's made by a Chinese company called Blue. So B-L-U. B-L-U. So I bought one for Patricia. I'm going to give it to her Christmas morning with the SIM card for this company called Simple Mobile. It was like $141 with the tax. I got it for Patty in pink, and I'm going to give it to her Christmas morning. I think it's a wonderful, wonderful gift for somebody who doesn't have a cell phone or wants a less expensive cell phone, and the bill is only $25 a month. In my case, I'm going to pay it for Patricia for one full year. Get back to that, and to Leo, just a Christmas suggestion.
And Dick, I don't know if you heard me, I'm back, I'm on the base. My portable died.
N1YDY.
YDY, you're after Matt. Yes, thank you for that information, Rich. KC2YDT, we're now hearing you. So go right ahead, Matt.
Okay, what I was saying was there's different types of clothing for environments that you're in. In the New York area, even upstate, on the border of the Canadian area, in the temperate area, a lot of people, they think of getting the warmest coat and they think they're fine. But that's where they go wrong, because then they start to sweat. I personally recommend layers. I'm a big fan of layers. Let me drop. of the underneath layer, the wicking layer, the clothing layer, the insulation layer, and then the shell layer. And each port has a very, you know, important factor of it. I personally own 4 different types of long underwear. I have my ultralight, I have my lightweight,